Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality rather than illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about the latest issues as always. Hi, Joel. How are we doing?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. Good to be with you.
Well, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, first of all, it's quite a few big topics. The G20 conference and the protests that went on there. The financial reform bill has passed. The Elena Kagan nomination. Let's start off with financial reform bill. It's both a monster and a sellout. It's a monster to the small firms who get pulled into this network of excess regulation, and a sellout as far as reining in the big predator banks. The Wall Street Journal summed up just how threatening this supposed restriction of Wall Street turned out to be, not very. The sweeping overhaul, it said, which could be signed into law by July 4th, I say, no way, there's problems getting enough senators on board after Senator Byrd's death, would put smaller U.S. banks and financial markets under tighter control for years to come. Wall Street executives and analysts said the legislation, however, was not as tough as they had feared. Well, that's an understatement. Naturally, investors reacted by bidding up stocks of the big financial companies. That should tell you something. With the market flat and going down, shares of banks and brokers rose 2.7%. Companies most affected by the rules, like Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, rose even further. Naturally, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner helped shape the financial bill. In other words, the country's being hit with another massive law that will only place a few token restrictions on the predator big banks that siphoned off billions of dollars in speculative bets in the marketplace, while giving massive new regulatory powers to the Fed and two other federal agencies, new federal agencies, to control small financial transactions, which have never been the problem. Well, what else do we expect when Congress allows Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner to dictate the terms of the bill? Did anyone really believe that Geithner was going to curtail Wall Street, people he works for? The L.A. Times claims that the finance reform package won't change much about Wall Street, and I think they're right. Though the legislation would put limits on Wall Street banks, it would outright bar many new activities, including rapid-fire stock and bond trading and the packaging of complex securities to hedge their investments. However, the legislation leaves largely untouched some of the biggest concerns about the financial industry that led to the mortgage meltdown. These include worries that banks have grown so that they're too big to fail, and their pay system built on the annual bonus that has made short-term trading profits the primary focus of these companies. Greg Hunter of USA Watchdog says the much-awaited finance reform bill was finished up in an overnight marathon House and committee session. Now the full Congress will most likely pass the final legislation and send it to the president. This bill, he said, came about by the near collapse of the financial system, brought about by reckless bankers with little oversight and regulation. Actually, in my opinion, it was criminal bankers who engaged in outright fraud by creating derivatives instruments of credit and insurance with no financial backing whatsoever. They were in collusion with the rating agencies to falsify the value and then sold them to others while hedging on the other side that they would eventually fail. That's exactly what happened.
And I think people have to really understand that we have a ruling financial elite. And basically, we are seeing the greatest transfer of wealth that has ever taken place from the little guy to the major bankers. And, of course, this has always been the fear that the bankers would take care over this country. Jackson, Andrew Jackson, warned about this. We have a book written in the year 1899 talking about when the banks would take over our country. This gives power to the Federal Reserve System, and the Federal Reserve is controlled by the banks. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this afternoon, Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And Joel has just been talking about this new financial regulatory bill, over 3,000 pages. Even Christopher Dodd, who wrote the bill, said, we'll have to wait till it gets enforced before we can figure out what's in it. Here's the man who wrote the bill, supposedly. We're going to have to wait until it gets enforced to figure out what's in it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the transfer of power over the financial system to the Federal Reserve System, which is a privately owned federal bank, which is controlled by the bank. So what you've done is give the banks the ability to regulate themselves, but of course just the big banks, because this is going to destroy the small banks. And then, of course, you're going to see ever more banks going down, being bought up by other banks, and then those falling and being bought up by other banks, until eventually we're only going to have a couple of major banks. We have six major banks today, and then we've got about 8,000 small ones, but of course they're going down every single week. We've already lost 83 or 84 so far this year, and probably lose a similar number, maybe even far more before this year is over. And this is all designed to destroy the banking industry and centralize power in the hands of a few wealthy and powerful people who tie into what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. Go right ahead, Joel.
Well, there's a provision called the Volcker Rule that's supposed to ban banks from investing with hedge funds and private equity funds. They're claiming that the hedge funds and private equity funds are the ones that had to be bailed out and that they nearly made the big banks insolvent. Just really untrue. The big banks themselves were engaging all these things. They had primary relationships with these other hedge funds. The Volcker Rule was watered down in the bill so the banks can still invest in these types of activities, but with less money and with more transparency. This can easily be bypassed, of course, by spreading the speculation among several connected entities. Banks would have to set up separate capitalized affiliates to trade derivatives and energy swaps. And that's, really very little change from what they did before. The more than $600 trillion derivatives market was supposed to get some tough regulation and force banks to spin off these risky trading operations. But loopholes were created for the banks so they can keep trading those profitably. Profitable and risky securities. There are some new restrictions, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not nearly enough. Some say the real value of the derivatives market is more than $100 trillion. Now, how could the derivatives market be that large, given that the outstanding number of total dollars is somewhat near $200 trillion? How can you have $1,000 trillion in derivatives? Well,
Hold the thought. Anyway, of course, Joel is just talking about this new legislation. And, of course, it's really not going to solve the problem at all. And he's talking about the derivative market, which is estimated to be $1,000 trillion, which is basically a quadrillion. And so how can you have that when all the money in the whole world is only a couple of hundred trillion? Well, go right ahead. I think the money in the world, I've heard it was something like 60 trillion. Is it really that high?
Yeah. If you count money that's printed in currency and in bank accounts that's legitimately assigned to someone else, that's what we call monetized. In other words, it's put into real form that can be traded, and it's assigned an owner, either by who's got the cash or who's has the money in the bank account. Now, when regulators allow private banks and companies, not even to speak of the Federal Reserve, which has an open printing press, when you allow private banks and companies to actually create contracts denominated in dollars that have no reserve requirements and no cash backing requirements, literally anyone can write a contract for $1 trillion in obligations without having to actually have any money invested. Now, suckers were induced to buy these worthless guarantees based upon the false credit ratings that agencies gave them and the supposed billions that these investment banks were worth was supposedly the backing of these contracts, but it turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. So you see what I'm saying is that we have money, trillions of dollars, Sam, that has not been monetized ever. There are contracts floating around. There are futures contracts that are naked, meaning that there's no backing behind them. They don't have to borrow. They don't have to set aside any money. They just write out a contract for $100 billion or something, And in essence, they've created money that somebody's got to fulfill someday.
Well, I think we know who's going to fulfill it. We saw that with AIG when they said, well, AIG is just too large to fail, so we're going to have to go in and bail them out, give them $185 billion, so they could transfer massive amounts of money, I think $12 billion to Goldman Sachs and $12 million to J.P. Morgan Chase, so that they could each pay out, you know, $20 or $30 billion, $20 billion to their employees as bonuses. So the American taxpayer told, oh, these institutions are too large to fail, so we've got to give them $185 billion so they can give the money to the big banks so they can pay these obscene bonuses. And where's the outcry? Well, you know, after all, it's too big to fail. We wouldn't want the whole system to come down, would we? Go right ahead.
Well, of course, the outcry didn't come because nobody had to pay it. The money was invented. It was created to bail them out. Now, technically, we're still on the hook, but I'll tell you, Stan, these politicians are never going to sack anyone with the bill. They're simply going to build up debts until they can't pay the interest, and then we'll get a war to wipe those debts off the books. You mark my word, it will come to pass.
And, of course, with that, of course, will come the destruction of the value of our currency and the impoverishment of our people.
That's right. Not to mention the destruction of a good portion of the country, the destruction of the electricity net, we'll be back to a third-world country in an instant. Well, the trouble is, this was all a Ponzi scheme. The billions the investment banks were worth mostly came from the sales of these naked contracts, and the money was going out in the form of massive executive compensation almost as fast as it was coming in. Now, to keep up appearances of solvency, most of the money was still on the books in these investment banks, but offset by future obligations to pay the funds out to the executives as bonuses. Now, this was done for tax reasons so that the executives weren't required to take it all at once, which would have been a huge tax burden. They basically had it owing to them so they could draw it out over time. But this was all a house of cards, and the bailout is the only thing that made the bank solvent again temporarily. By injecting TARP money into AIG, AIG, as you said, was able to make good on the empty derivatives guarantees and keep the scheme going. It's still grossly insolvent. I want to be very clear about that. But as long as new speculative money is still being generated to pay off the minority of defaults that are coming in, the scheme keeps going. What should clearly have been labeled as fraud was specifically exempted by regulation so that no one could be prosecuted for this kind of thing. And that's the great evil. There were many people who participated in it, from congressmen through the Treasury and the Fed, as well as the major investment banks that paid millions to lobbyists get the congressman to change the various laws and make sure that there were no requirements on reserve requirements on derivatives. Well, the rating agencies that gave top grades to toxic debt dodged a bullet in this bill. They were let off the hook. The new bill makes it harder, not easier, but harder for investors to sue the bond rating companies for losses, just the opposite of what they should be encouraged to do. Also, not much will get done until after a two-year study on the rating agencies is done by regulators. These folks vouched for trillions of dollars of insolvent stuff that was supposed to be equal to the risk-free return of treasuries. Those wildly optimistic ratings helped cause the financial crisis, and nothing is going to be done for 2 years. In my view, this is simply outrageous and borders on a criminal cover-up. As Tyler Durden noted, Barney Frank, a corrupt homosexual congressman from Massachusetts, also helped let the big boys off the hook. He said, in case you just can't get enough of Barney Frank simply oozing truth, integrity, and unbribable honesty, in other words, everything that the American Congress does, his latest Bloomberg TV interview is for you. Overall, Barney mumbles about this and that, discusses whether the bill will make banks less profitable. It won't. Clarifies the 3% loophole for J.P. Morgan's investments, notes the surprising $19 billion bank levy, now gone, yet runs like a scolded schoolgirl from the second Fannie and Freddie, also known as the biggest disaster of his career, are mentioned. But he says, my Republican colleagues like to forget the fact that during the 12 years they controlled Congress, they did nothing about Fannie and Freddie Mac. When the Democrats took power in 2007, we passed a bill that gave them the power to put them into conservatorship. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac today are not what they were thanks to a bill passed by the Democrats. They are in conservatorship. The notion that we haven't done anything is a lie, and they know that. Well, in receivership, both constitute a massive financial sinkhole into which the taxpayers are still having to bail them out at billions of dollars each quarter.
I think people have to understand that the liability for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is something like $5 trillion, and a lot of that is going to, we're going to have to end up paying.
Because it's in conservatorship. So he didn't solve anything by claiming that conservatorship was a responsible thing for the Democrats to do. Conservatorship just means that the liabilities are now on the federal government and that it can't be liquidated.
And, of course, what they should have done was just let it go bankrupt and to pick up the pieces and sell it off but to others. Instead of that, now we are liable for that $5 trillion. The American taxpayers, we don't have that amount of money. The entire budget for the year, I think, is $3.4 trillion, and yet we took on a $5 trillion liability, and probably 20 to 30% of that will eventually be paid by our children and grandchildren.
Well, as CBS News noted, the House passed this sweeping bill this week. The death of Democratic Senator Robert Byrd of Virginia will delay the final votes on the bill. Byrd, Congressman's longest-serving member, died at 92. While the senator's health was fragile for several years, the vote has proved critical for Democrats since the death of Ted Kennedy last year put them one vote shy of a filibuster. With Byrd's death, it's now unclear whether the Democrats have enough votes to overcome a Republican filibuster. They're certainly going to continue to rely on perennial liberal Republicans that sometimes vote with the Democrats, like Olympia Snowe in Maine and Senator Scott Brown, the false conservative from Massachusetts. Compromising Senator Scott Brown voted for the bill originally and hinted he might withdraw his support due to the $19 billion tax provision on banks, noting that he promised not to approve any tax increases that would surely be passed on to the consumers. Naturally, the tax provision is being axed. It matters little to Congress. They'll enact a few selective taxes where they can, but if they have to give them up, what's another $19 billion to the $13 trillion deficit? They can just print the money. But one of the worst things to happen in this second vote by the House is that they rejected Ron Paul's audit the Fed requirement a second time, 198 votes to 229. The audit was included in a Republican motion to send the Dodd-Frank Federal Empowerment Act back to committee. If the measure had been approved, it would have been changed the bill to include the audit. Even worse, the majority of those who voted against it were co-sponsors of Ron Paul's original bill. Now, that confirms what I have long said, Dr. Stan. Those people were only signing on to the bill because it became popular to be for auditing the Fed. But once it came to voting against the Fed, they put their allegiance where it really was, with the establishment.
Well, I think it's so important people understand that we have the finest congressman money could buy. And when they understand that, these people have sold their souls to stay in office there. And, of course, they usually have things on many of them. They can blackmail them very, very readily. They've had sexual escapades or they're homosexual. And we've got an awful lot of closeted homosexuals there who can so easily be blackmailed to go along with the establishment. Go right ahead.
Well, it's so true. They do provide monetary benefits for all of those to play along. It isn't the only motivation, obviously. The immunity provisions, the being part of the establishment that can control the courts, prosecutions, Department of Justice, anything in their favor, plays heavily upon their mind, especially when they have as many private sins as they do. Well, in other news, the Nordic euro, a new currency, is being touted as the dollar killer. I'm not buying this new rumor theory about the demise of the dollar. Started with Jim Willie of the Hat Trick Letter. I think he's way off base there, and it's getting a lot of traction among those eagerly looking for reasons why the financial powers that be will soon fail.
Well, it's going to be very interesting. We keep hearing these rumors, but of course, where are you going to get a currency that is widely accepted as the dollar? And until it really begins to lose its value, people will continue supporting it. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. But one day the dollar is going to fail. It's just a matter of when. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I think it's very, shows a lack of understanding to underestimate the power of the powers that be. My belief is that any new widely used gold-backed, this is Jim Woolley talking, says, my belief is that any new widely gold-backed or hard asset currency embraced by the majority of nations of the world will act as a dollar killer and usher the United States into the third world. Now, I say this is nonsense. No nation or group of nations is going to produce a true gold currency. Now, a true gold currency is one that is redeemable in gold, not just, quote, gold-backed by non-redeemable and unaudited gold holdings. Now, the euro is claimed to be a gold-backed currency. And it's not gold-backed unless the people who hold the paper euros can go to a bank and collect gold in return. Now, that's the only defense against printing fiat money, and it's the way the dollar used to be. It's a gold or silver certificate. You could get a fixed amount of gold or silver. So if they started to dilute the money by printing too much paper, people would say, hey, the gold is worth more than the paper, so I'm going to turn it in for gold. And then that's when the jig is up. If holders of gold-backed currencies could trade it in for gold, it would absolutely limit and control those currency's ability to be inflated, and no government wants to lose that power. That's why this simply is a claim that hasn't been thought out. The Nordic euro isn't going to be any more gold-backed than the dollar or the euro itself.
All right. Well, have they even got to come up with the Nordic euro? Is this just all talk?
Well, it's the same thing as it's a Nordic euro that is being created for crude oil sales as a requirement of part of the alliance of being in part of OPEC. It's just like Iran starting an oil bourse in euros. It will have no more effect. Oil is traded mostly in dollars around the world, and that's the way it's going to remain. There aren't any, I mean, think about it here. The U.S., you would have to print in order to replace the dollar, depending on the values that you assigned to the new currency. I mean, you would have to replace at least $100 trillion to cover all the markets that the euro would. And how would they do that? Just print up $100 trillion Nordic euros, and that's supposed to have value? They certainly can't make that hard currency-based or gold-based. Which of those nations have that much gold that they want to sink into a currency and stick it there and risk put it at risk in redeemability? It just isn't going to happen. I mean, people who make these statements about replacing the dollar with another currency simply haven't thought out the difficulties of doing that.
Okay, you're right ahead.
In other financial news, the G20 engaged in a real shell game. Everyone is jumping on the deficit-cutting bandwagon. As the G20 summit winded down, world leaders were all, quote, reaching agreement on how to handle the deficit, which was the most contentious of the two-day agenda. Leaders, every one of them, pledged to cut their deficits in half by 2013. And that's in line with the target that President Obama pledged to have the U.S. Deficit within 2 years. But it's all talk. Easy at that, as long as they put the deadline so far in advance, no one will remember when it comes around. Some new crisis will always dominate the news at that juncture. In contrast, the L.A. Times correctly points out that the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, Geithner, urges G20 leaders to continue government spending. He says the global recovery...
Hold that thought here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, on one hand, if you want the economy to recover and pick up, you've got to keep a deficit spending. If you begin to contract deficit spending, then we will plunge into the second part of our recession or into a deflationary depression. So, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to increase spending? Well, apparently a lot of the countries want to cut back on excessive spending and want to get their deficit under control, and the Americans seem to be intent upon just spend and spend and spend our way out of prosperity, or spend our way to prosperity.
Well, of course, as you know, we can't spend our way into prosperity. You can't create money to create prosperity. All you do is create a bubble, and it postpones the inevitable collapse, makes it worse as you go. But you see, they want it both ways. They want to chastise Europe for profligate lending to Greece, Spain, and Portugal, and Ireland, and Iceland. And yet when they want to crack down and put austerity measures, then it threatens to collapse. They say you've got to do stimulus spending. Well, frankly, stimulus spending is going to win out on this. That's really the only thing they've got left. They found out in Greece through all of the riots that the people wouldn't tolerate cutbacks in government spending, which is very much directed towards the welfare state that they run in Greece. Privately, Obama was meeting with all the leaders encouraging spending. The Obama administration was pressing leaders more than a year ago to promote growth through government deficit spending. Spooked by economic meltdowns in Greece and elsewhere, European leaders came to those talks concerned about racking up damaging levels of debt. And a proposal of a punitive global tax on banks to fund future bailouts was meeting opposition from all of the nations. The tax idea died. Giant banks, while bracing for a wave of tighter regulation in Washington, will not have to face a new global tax on capital and liquidity anytime soon. The world's biggest economies have been developing rules that would require banks to hold more capital and better equipped to absorb losses. All of that is good, in my opinion. But it became clear on Sunday at the meeting that the group of 20 countries, it could be years before that takes effect. Now, that's actually good for national sovereignty. You don't want to have an international control aspect which can force an international tax on banks, because the worst thing you can do with all that money is give it to some organization internationally to spend it, and they'll do so to destroy additional national sovereignty. So it doesn't look good. Governments, no matter how they spin this, no matter how much they talk about fiscal responsibility, the only thing they're going to do is continue to spend. The only thing that's going to shield people from the effects of hyperinflation is by the sheer quantity of dollars that are out there. Even at $3 trillion a year, if you were to print that much money, that would only be 1.5% inflation of the total money supply. And so you can't have an Argentine-style hyperinflation, a German-style hyperinflation, unless you have a currency that is being inflated at least 20 to 40 to 50%. In fact, in Germany and in Argentina, often the rate was up to 1,000%. I mean, literally, you don't have enough printing presses in the world to print that much dollars at this time. So I think they've got a long way to go in terms of inflation, and that's not going to be the fear. The fear is, of course, that they're going to run out of ability to pay the interest on the debt. That you can calculate, according to present trends, about the year 2020, and that almost guarantees, Stan, that they'll give us a war before that time to divert everybody's attention from the coming debt default. And I think that's how this is going to unravel, not going to unravel by a collapse of the dollar directly.
All right, fine. Well, we'll just wait and see. But whatever is going to happen, there's going to have to be a cataclysmic event because, of course, of this massive debt with no way ever to pay it off. And it's just going to keep growing and growing and growing.
That's a key element you said, Dr. Stan. There's no way it can be paid off. I mean, there's about, in debt and obligations to the federal government, about $300,000 per family. Who's got that kind of money to give to the government? It can never be paid off. It never will be paid off. Well, there's a lot of examples about the G20 bad cops. This has happened before. I've got a burgeoning file on the growing problem of law enforcement personnel that act more like thugs than cops. Evidence again surfaced at the G20 rights, at the G20 that rights have been, that initial perpetrators of the riots were policemen dressed in civilian clothes.
And what you're basically saying is they dressed the policemen up in civilian clothes to commit acts of atrocities so they could justify then police response to the acts that have been created by the agent provocateurs. Is that pretty well it?
Exactly correct.
And this is a technique they use routinely to discredit anybody who, of course, opposes to this move towards the New World Order and ultimately the New World Religion. We'll be back in just a moment with Joel Skousen.
God bless America, land
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, Joel.
Well, there now has surfaced information and photographic evidence that really proves this point. Terry Burrows of Global Research had this report today. He said Toronto right now is in the midst of a massive government media propaganda fraud. As events unfold, it is becoming increasingly clear that the Black Bloc, that's what they call ruffians dressed in black with masked faces that run around breaking windows and causing riots, are actually undercover police operatives engaged in powerful provocations to eclipse and invalidate legitimate G20 citizens protesting.
And that's exactly what they did at the battle in Seattle here 4 or 5 years ago, where there were agent provocateurs. Most people were there to demonstrate legitimately, and then they had their agent provocateurs dressed, in their black masks and certainly in their leotards, and they were going around breaking windows and burning cars, and that then justified the response until people understand these are standard techniques used by government to discredit opposition. Nothing makes sense.
That's right. It's sometimes very difficult to prove, but they were able to prove it in Canada in 2007 at the Montebello riots that occurred against another globalist meeting. A Quebec union leader caught and outed three masked undercover Quebec provincial police operatives who were dressed in Black Bloc protesters about to start a riot by throwing rocks at the security police. And they have pictures on the Internet, and I've got links to that in my current World Affairs brief coming out tomorrow. If any of your listeners want that, today's brief that we're talking about, they can email me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com to get that. But it shows these policemen down on the ground. What's interesting about this picture, Dr. Stan, if I can describe it to you, you got two people on the ground with the other police in riot gear on top of them, and their boots are all showing to the camera. In other words, the people laying on the ground have their feet out, soles up, and you can see these brand-new lug-sole boots with this little yellow embedded rubber label in the bottom of the tread, and you can see it on both of those. And then you have the riot police with their boots showing, and it's the exact same symbol. All brand-new boots, exact same type of boots.
Well, I think the people have to really understand that this use of the agent provocateur to actually create an artificial opposition so that you can then justify increasing power. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel was just talking how they've demonstrated, certainly in Canada, that the Canadian government uses agent provocateurs in demonstrations, and this is why you want to be very careful going to a demonstration, because they'll have their agent provocateurs there to create an incident to just discredit of people who are really trying to legitimately demonstrate in redress of their grievances. Which, of course, here in America, we're guaranteed the right to do that by our Constitution. They don't have that right in Canada, and the government is certainly taking it away. Well, they can get out and demonstrate, but, of course, the provocateurs will be there to discredit them. Our telephone number is we're not going to put out our number right now. I want Joel to put out his number, or at least tell people how they can get a copy of the World Affairs Brief. And I do want to mention that we do carry Joel's books. He has 3 books on the secure home and certainly on strategic relocation. And in times like this, with a very definite chance of increasing tempo of violence later in this year, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it certainly could, why you certainly want to think about how to secure your safety for yourself and your family. Those 3 books are excellent. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927, the Strategic Home, Strategic Location, and there's one other, 1-800-544-8927. But Joel, you tell our listeners how they can get a copy of the World Affairs Brief, and then if you want to briefly mention your books, go right ahead.
Well, the World Affairs Brief is my attempt to alert people to the kind of information that is being selectively omitted from the news, like this evidence of policemen acting as agent provocateurs and terrorists. And simply, you won't find any mainstream news source mentioning these very same photographs, even though they're all over the net now. It's very widely spread, but there's a complete blackout, and it shows you that there is prejudice in the news. So my effort, my career has been dedicated to two major things. One is to alert people and to analyze what's going on in the news through my World Affairs Brief, and the other thing is to get people to prepare in case we can't win this battle. I mean, it's not defeatist to prepare in advance, to make plans for an orderly retreat if we cannot undo this thing. You know, one of the prime things that I'm most concerned about is most conservatives, especially Christian conservatives, feel like if they pray hard enough and if they rally the vote, they can turn this country around and force it back to the Constitution. But they fail to realize that there is a major conspiracy of power that controls both major political parties and the media, and they have tremendous power to divert public attention to false saviors, false reform. There are very few people like Ron Paul out there who we can trust not to be turned. You have a lot of people like Scott Brown, charismatic, handsome, that can be elected as a conservative or as a Tea Party candidate. When they get to office, they don't ever perform that way. And so I've always attempted to. I spent 30 years as a high security designer trying to help people prepare designing high security homes. And when I retired from that, I put my work into three major books: The Secure Home, 700 pages of everything from high security construction to total self-sufficiency in a home, strategic relocation to help people find safe places to live and develop contingency plans if they can't get out of the big cities, how to implement a high security shelter is about doing a safe room within an existing home. So a lot of these things are very, very useful, practical, do-it-yourself materials, and as you mentioned, they're available from Radio Liberty.
All right, we'll go right ahead.
Well, there is a great deal of hypocrisy in the government's moral judgments we're finding. Jeremy Scahill this year has cataloged some of the dreadful hypocrisy we find behind the scenes, not only in the Bush administration, but the Obama administration. Both claim the high for the moral high ground. Obama recently fired General McChrystal for his staff's unsavory criticism of government officials. And yet Obama continues to hide the fact that continuing contracts are being granted to the notorious Blackwater Jay Company, mercenary contractors whose men were guilty of actually killing civilians. And even McChrystal has been an abject yes man over the years. It's amazing what his background is. For example, McChrystal was involved in the torture of detainees at Camp Nama in Iraq, had a primary role in the cover-up of Pat Tillman's death and other dark acts involving his time as commander of the Joint Special Operations Command. It's amazing, too, that he was caught in an interview or being overheard by someone down in his command telling one of his special forces guys that you better be out there hitting four or five targets tonight. He was talking to a Navy SEAL in the hallway of his headquarters. Then he added, but I'm going to have to scold you in the morning for it, though, meaning I'm going to play this role of we want, you know, out there to get out there shooting people, but I'm going to have to, criticize you when you kill civilians. So there's kind of a dual standard there, a very dishonesty that's going on in the military. Unfortunately, General Petraeus is even a greater yes man. He's now looked upon as someone who's going to salvage the Afghan war, just like he did the Iraq situation. The Iraq situation, in fact, is in great turmoil, has not been salvaged. They haven't even been able, 2 months after the elections, to form a government yet. It's just incredible what's going on, and it would fall back into internecine conflict as soon as the U.S. leaves, and that's why the U.S. is not going to be leaving there anytime soon. In fact, the supposed withdrawal from Afghanistan is not going to start in 2011 either. It's only getting started, and that's what Petraeus is in there for. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Kagan nomination hearings. I think she's lying to beat the band. Washington Post is gloating about how Kagan is been on a charm offensive, smiling and joking with people, evading any embarrassing gaffes. Others are decrying the vacuous grandstanding by various senators pontificating on their own agendas rather than grilling the the Supreme Court nominee, but few expected Kagan to outright lie about her radical legal position and pretend to be in line with those who believe in original intent of the Constitution. I mean, this is incredible, Dr. Stan. David Ingram reports, during a full day of questioning before the Senate, this was the second day, Kagan said she never broke the law when she restricted military recruiting at Harvard and declared that Supreme Court decisions regarding gun rights are settled law. Now, that implies that she won't try to undo them. That's an absolute lie. She disavowed any statements by President Barack Obama about the role of empathy in judging, meaning that you can have empathy for people and distort the law if you want to be an empathetic judge. Kagan even sided with one of the court's most conservative members, Antonin Scalia, in endorsing the, quote, originalism method of constitutional interpretation. That method, of course, emphasizes what the authors of the U.S. Constitution consider to be its original meaning, called original intent. She said, sometimes they lay down very specific rules, sometimes they lay down broad general principles. Either way, we apply what they tried to do, Kagan said. In a way, we are all originalists, and that, Stan, is an outright lie.
Well, what she means is we should be, but I'm sure you're absolutely right. I'm sure she's saying what people want to hear, and when she gets in, why, she will proceed with President Obama's program of destroying the Constitution of the United States, which he has total contempt for.
Well, Kagan has never been a judge, has no judicial experience, but does idolize judicial activist judges. As Judge Robert Bork, himself a Supreme Court nominee, said recently, Kagan has praised Judge Aaron Barak, the retired Chief Judge of the Supreme Court of Israel. In 2006, Kagan praised Barak at an event at Harvard Law School. She called Barak my judicial hero and said, and Bork said, he is the judge who has best advanced democracy, or she said, he's the judge who has best advanced democracy, human rights, and the rule of law and justice. But Bork then proceeded to outline how Judge Barak was the most extravagantly activist judge in Israel's history. If confirmed, he says you will have a court. If she is confirmed, you will have a court, which is much more to the left than we have today. And Senator Jim DeMint, one of the true conservatives in the Senate now, countered that Kagan's real philosophy, that court precedent trumps the original words of the Constitution, is a serious danger to the limiting power of the Constitution. He said, when a president and Congress collude to pass and sign into law unconstitutional power grabs, bailouts, and takeovers, there's only one immediate backstop, the Supreme Court. Every branch of government has an obligation to preserve, defend, and uphold the Constitution, and if the legislature and executive overstep the boundaries, it's the job of the judicial branch to stop them. On the other hand, if the Supreme Court doesn't say no when the two other branches go too far, there's no tax that can't be levied, no mandate that can't be imposed, no regulation that can't be instituted, and no industry that can't be taken over. I might add that the states also have the right to basically say we won't do it and exercise their Tenth Amendment's rights. He continues, the only recourse Americans have is to remove and replace members of Congress and the president slowly through the election process. As I've pointed out many times, that doesn't work when the media and the establishment within the Republican Party is so apt at putting forth false conservatives who say the right thing during the election and then turn into rhinos or Republicans in name only after elected, like Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown. When the Supreme Court judges, says DeMint, who are unelected and given lifetime appointments, refuse to say no when the Constitution say they should, it can take much longer to undo the damage, if at all. Judges who rely on flawed precedent or their own judgment instead of the Constitution to justify rulings can say yes to anything. This is precisely, he says, how liberal judges have rubber-stamped tyrannical actions by government in the past and how they will do it in the future. On these grounds, he says, I'm compelled to oppose Solicitor General Elena Kagan's nomination. During my private meeting with her, I asked Ms. Kagan questions about the limits of federal power. Her answers indicated her judicial philosophy is not grounded in the Constitution. She would grant way too much deference to precedent. In a sense, the Constitution itself should be the litmus test In my talk with Ms. Kagan, she was willing to talk about precedents, but knew very little about the Constitution itself.
Well, you know, basically, although she is Jewish, a large group of rabbis representing the conservative element of Judaism has come out firmly against her because they say, you know, her position on homosexuality and on abortion and morality is totally in opposition to the feelings of traditional Jewishness here in this country. So even though she is Jewish, the rabbis are coming out against her, and with good reason.
Yes, indeed. DeVine got around to saying as to what she should be asked. You know, they play a lot of games now, but I'm not going to commit to anything about how I rule on such and such. But you can ask questions, like DeVine says, about how you would interpret certain things in the Constitution. That isn't a ruling. You can't technically evade that. He would have asked, he said, aside from what the Supreme Court has ruled in the past, what do you think of the Commerce Clause means? Her answer would probably go along the line of, well, it's settled law because of precedents. But that's not an acceptable answer, he says. The Constitution always should trump precedent. The Constitution is the precedent. The Interstate Commerce Clause, of course, has had a dramatic effect on the lives of Americans ever since the New Deal. It was the key issue in Wickard versus Filburn, which tested progressive President Franklin Roosevelt's 1938 Agricultural Adjustment Act. FDR believed farmers had a right to sell wheat at a certain price, and he put quotas on it to drive up the price. Then, by stretching the Commerce Clause and engaging in hypothetical gymnastics, the New Deal court packed with Roosevelt's appointees said crops grown on private land for personal consumption could fall under federal regulation because of the Commerce Clause. And not only because, even, you know, that's incredible, how about crops grown, you know, don't cross state lines. Well, they claim because they could be intermixed and be indistinguishable, that everything had to be grouped under the potential of interstate commerce. So they're capable of all kinds of bizarre interpretations in order to get the Constitution where they want it to be.
But, Joel, I think people have to really understand it's all about centralization of power in Washington, D.C. And the secret of America was that we were to have a weak federal government, and matters dealing with life, liberty, property, and commerce were to be kept at the state and the local level. Limit the power of government so men could be free. Increase the power of the central government, and you will have tyranny. And that is just what the Brotherhood of Darkness, the people working behind the scenes, want. And they put Obama in place, but then they put George Bush there. And he was centralizing power in Washington, as did Bill Clinton before him. It's a gradual process, a little at a time. But we're progressively losing our freedom. And people don't understand. They control both political parties and make mockery out of the electoral process.
Absolutely right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Russian spy scandal. Here's the official line from the New York Times. An FBI investigation that began at least 7 years ago culminated with the arrest on Sunday of 10 people in Yonkers, Boston, and Northern Virginia. The documents detailed what the authorities called the Illegals Program, an ambitious long-term effort by the SVR, the successor to the KGB, to plant Russian spies in the United States to gather information and recruit more agents. The alleged agents were directed to gather information on nuclear weapons, American policy toward Iran, CIA leadership, congressional politics, and many others. But they weren't even accused of spying. They were trained and inserted into U.S. society clear back at the fall of the Soviet Union and Boris Yeltsin, so much for that being a legitimate change in Soviet attitudes about spying. But these kinds of soft spies are a dime a dozen. The fact that the FBI is outing this group rather than the really dangerous spies that infest the State Department, FBI, and CIA is the real story. The American public is being set up for something, and that something always benefits Russian relations with the U.S. government, which is covering for Russian rearmament. Well, Bill Gertz, the Washington Times, is the official right-wing go-to guy for disinformation experts in government targeting conservatives. His story sets up the conservative public for the expected, quote, backlash from the Russians. He says, U.S. intelligence agencies are on alert for retaliation by Moscow, including a mass arrest of U.S. diplomats or intelligence officers who could then be used in a SWAT for 10 people arrested on suspicious roles. While this may be true, the kinds of spy and counter-spy operations that the U.S. and Russia engage in publicly is only for show and for safe-facing. saving face. Here's the real dangerous news. Gertz announces that the U.S., as usual, is bending over backwards to continue U.S.-Russian intelligence and military exchanges. Now, that's where the real spying happens.
And why are we exchanging, you know, secrets with the Chinese communists and the Russians? Why are we providing them with all the weapons, information, so they can build the sophisticated weapons with which to attack us? Bill Clinton gave the Chinese communists the ability to MIRV their missiles and with accurate targeting. We supposedly did it for a small campaign contribution. Ladies and gentlemen, we've helped the communists since the inception of communism. We can't let the American people realize we've created the best enemy that money could buy. Well, Joel, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, the essence of what's going on here is no matter what the Russians do, and you have to really question when the U.S. is always trying to cozy up to the Russians. First of all, the U.S. knows that the Russians are an eventual enemy. They're covering for massive information about rearmament the Russians are going through, their underground nuclear bunker systems, and they're cheating on them. They don't do anything to upset U.S.-Russian relationships. Well, they used to say that during the Cold War because Russia was so powerful. Now they don't have an excuse for it, other than the fact that Russia could become more powerful. We don't want them to become our enemy. They always have an excuse to justify this kind of permissiveness. So a knowledgeable U.S. official who declined to be identified, what Gertz is saying is, this is my source in government who always keeps telephoning me. The goal on our side is to keep this in inside intelligence channels, meaning we keep this a secret from the public. If the Russians play it smart and don't overreact, they can limit the impact on the broader relationship. He says U.S.-Russian intelligence cooperation will continue when it's in our national interest to do so. Well, my question is, why is it ever in our national interest to share intelligence and allow their spies to have access to our top officials anytime that they want? Word is circulating, says Gertz, in intelligence circles that President Obama is expecting to find a way for the accused Russian agents to be released and sent back under a conciliatory reset of our relationship with Moscow.
But Joel, until people understand that the enemy is not in Moscow and Beijing, they're the people, the socialists, are working with the Council on Foreign Relations and in our government, the Trilateral Commission. This is the real enemy working to destroy our nation, not the people in other countries who we're subsidizing and helping and transferring military technology to, and the average individual has no grasp of what's really going on.
Well, that's right. So this may be the real reason for outing this mild form of espionage. One, so they don't have to out the dangerous ones, which the U.S. strangely knows about and tolerates. And two, so the public won't get upset when Obama cuts a deal with Russia to get these spies released. He can get away with that to see if they're considered just ordinary people trying to spy or in a mild kind of way. So he's almost setting this thing up, arresting somebody so that he can release them to defuse and have an excuse to set up closer relationships with our future enemies.
Well, we live in a world gone mad. There's only a few people who realize what's going on. Everybody thinks we're crazy, but we're going to continue what we're doing. Our guest is Joel Skousen, World Affairs Brief. Joel, we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Joel was just talking about these so-called communist spies. So the communists are spying on us. Ladies and gentlemen, we've financed communism since its inception. If you have not yet, of course, read my pamphlet on the Communist-Capitalist Alliance, or certainly Professor Sutton's book on Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, you need to get this information. You need to see my DVD, my interview with Professor Sutton called The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. And so we have his book by that same topic. We do all of these things to entertain the American people. So we'll keep our attention on the external communists. The real enemy is right here in the United States. And they're at 58th to 68th Street in New York City, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission. And, of course, you must understand the enemy are the people here working with our country who financed communism since its inception so that we would not understand that the progressive move towards socialism socialism, bringing communists to power in country after country, like in Cuba, Fidel Castro. We knew Fidel Castro was a communist, and that's why we brought him to power. And if you haven't seen my DVD, The World Revolution, I interviewed the American ambassador to Cuba in 1959 and Earl T. Smith, a multi-billionaire, and he will tell you, we knew Fidel Castro was a communist. The State Department knew he was a communist. The CIA knew he was a communist, and they brought him to power. And then, of course, if you really want to understand what this is about, we have a book, it's called Memoirs, written by David Rockefeller, where he tells you how his daughters go down to visit good old Uncle Fidel. You know, they're such close friends with Fidel. Why are the daughters of David Rockefeller, who is the honorary chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, the founder and honorary chairman of the Northern chapter of the Trilateral Commission, a founding member and permanent member of the Bilderbergers, why are the communists, welcoming his daughters? Why does Fidel come up here to visit with David Rockefeller? You must understand, ladies and gentlemen, nothing as it appears to be. You get the book, you get Memoirs by David Rockefeller, where he actually talks about how he's a member of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States to bring about a new international order. Get it? And then he sort of poo-poos the idea that he says, but if it wasn't for us, I mean, how would the world be transformed? Haven't we raised the living standards in other countries? Aren't things better off here in America? If it hadn't been for us, how would it happened? And ladies and gentlemen, they did that. They've raised living standards throughout the world, but the plan is ultimately to destroy this nation. And all you need to do is read what his nephew wrote, the Earth Charter. You can get it from the internet or get it from Radio Liberty. Their intent is to destroy this nation, because their loyalty is elsewhere, and behind this are the powerful spirits of forces, which we describe in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com, and you can go there to the internet. You can listen 9 hours a day and not get anything accomplished, but you'll sure get a lot of great information, because we get some great guests like Joel Skousen. Well, you listen regularly, you'll get information you're not going to get elsewhere, and an entirely different slant on what's going on. Go to our webpage if you'd like a catalog. Of course, if you don't have the internet, why, we'll be glad to send you a free catalog, free newsletters. But we hope many of you, if you're in a position to join the Radio Liberty family, we'd certainly love to have you, welcome you to the family, because we're having some financial problems now. Some of our long-term supporters are having difficult times. If you can help, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't seen Alex Jones' great new DVDs, The Invisible Empire, Police State 4, if you haven't seen Constance Cumby, DVD on the emergence, or her, our 4-tape or 4-CD set with her on the Aquarian Conspiracy. The Aquarian Conspiracy. Why, give us a call. But then, ladies and gentlemen, please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.